This is a Pinball News production.
Hello, can everybody hear me? Yeah? Okay, good. Okay, we're going to talk about my experiences building a pinball machine. I've been working on a game for a while, and I brought it here. It's half working. It was fully working before I got here. However, you can see a little bit of it. I'm not going to be overly technical. There's so many topics you could cover. I really can't get into too much depth on any one subject. So I'll just try and go over it and give you some of the human aspects of it, and you know, the trials and tribulations, etc. Okay. So we'll go over the background, how to design and make a game. This game I called it Project GH 2006. And I'll give advice to anybody else who's crazy enough to do it like I did it, and maybe tell you smarter ways to do it. There's a lot of topics to go over, as I said, so I don't want to get too in-depth, and if you can, just hold the questions till the end so I can blast through these screens. Okay. Just a bit of background on how I got into wanting to design games. Back in 1993, I helped out with a company called Epic Mega Games, making PC shareware games. I designed a table you see up on the screen there called Pot of Gold. It's a simplistic game, but it was sort of inspired by Fish Tales, Wizard, and Expressway, let's say, back in that time period. And so you could play that on the PC. Next. After that, I worked on the next package that Epic worked on, which was called Extreme Pinball. And I worked on that from 1993 to 96, although the main package was released in 1995 for the PC and the original PlayStation. I designed three tables you can sort of see up there called Rock Makers, Monkey Mayhem, and Urban Chaos. So there was a lot of effort on my part just to think about these because I was getting paid. So when you get paid to do something, you tend to put some effort into it and apply some discipline and get excited about it. Next. I never had room to actually build a physical game. I had a really tiny room in my basement, so I could never really sort of indulge myself and build something physical. When we moved into a new house in 2001, I just felt like building anything, so I built this little, big EM game. I just called it Nut Hunt. It's really just a roll-down game with a couple of flippers and a pop bumper, and it kept score, like using Gottlieb parts like from 60s games. So that was my first effort. I just had enough room to build it, and stupidly I made it 24 by 48, instead of making it a bit smaller, and it doesn't really fit anywhere. So that was that. Then we fast forward to 2004. I got interested. I always wanted to learn electronics because I really didn't know anything about electronics. So I got started, and I found out these things called basic stamps, things, little microcontrollers you could easily program, and it seemed like the perfect thing to base building a game on that you could control electronically. So I took a solar ride playfield, a Gottlieb solar ride playfield, and wired it up to a PC with my software and hardware, and I can control it from that. And I called it SolarEye 2004 because that's the year I did the project. So you can see at the top there, I just have the laptop sitting there, the laptop screen, and otherwise you play the game, and I've got extra rules that you had over the original game, like a SolarEye spell sequence and stuff. And that turned out pretty good, but it took me 2 years just to do that. 2 years elapsed time in my spare time. And the project we've got here today, GH 2006, it's had many lives. This was originally supposed to be a PC simulation table as part of Extreme Pinball back in 1995, but I was too slow building it, so it didn't make it into the game. Then there was going to be an Extreme Pinball for Windows package, and this was going to be the first game, and everybody was working on it. But that project got canceled, and the Epic guy started working on this game called Unreal, which is probably a really smart move. Then, a little bit later, we were supposed to build this game. It was supposed to be part of a Symbian OS cell phone game, and there were some guys in the UK who were working on that, and we had contracts signed and real artists lined up, even though it was just for a cell phone, and it was looking all very promising. And then the programmer just disappeared. So after all these failed attempts, I thought, well, screw it. I like this game, and I really want to play it, so I'll build a real game. So screw all the simulations. Here it is. Fourth time lucky. Here's the actual game, you know, physically built. Go over and unveil this. So now we're going to unveil the game. I don't think this game is as worthy as about 1,000 other games that have been built over the years of having an introduction like this, but I just thought, you know, it's kind of neat. Whenever you find out about a game, it's usually you get a little notice on RGP or something, or you see a photo someplace, and information just kind of comes in and out, and then you hear about it. So I thought, well, this is kind of neat to actually come here. The only people in the world who've actually seen this game are my wife and kids, maybe my father-in-law and Mike sitting here. And that's about it. So no one has ever even seen this game, and no one has ever played it. And if I don't get it working, no one else will play it. But for now, this is as good as it's going to get. So Mike, go over, and you can take the thing off there. It's time to unwrap it. Again, I always thought this would be fun to do, so indulge me a bit here. Dun-da-da-da. The GI's out. Isn't that great? Dun-da-da-da. I know you can't see that well. It's called Gooligans Hooligans. It's a 1920s Chicago gangster theme, Al Capone, etc. And I know that sounds a lot like Kingpin, but I designed this before Kingpin was ever produced, and I remember back in 1996 or 95, whenever Kingpin came out, I thought, oh, everybody's going to think I stole their game. And then here it is 13 years later, and they're going to remake Kingpin, and everybody's going to think, oh, I stole his game, stole their game again. But I was just interested in this theme, so that's what I decided to build. It's sort of a fictional account of a gangster called Gargoyle Gooligan and his band of hooligans, and they just try and take over Chicago in the 1920s and rule the city. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about my experiences building this game and methodologies and techniques and some of my horror stories. And just go through the steps. Just if anybody's interested, it just sort of gives you a roadmap of how one person built a game. There's certainly other ways to go. Again, I'll try not to get too technical. I'm just going to breeze over some of these points for now. You can talk to me later if you're interested, and there's certainly other seminars that are going to have a similar type of content that you can go even further with. I call Solar Ride 2004 my Generation 1 platform. That's with all the basic stamps and other microcontrollers. This one, I would call it, is based on the Generation 2 or G2. This uses a single Atmel ATmega32 processor. And as I've got it configured, it supports 48 switches, 48 lamps, 16 to 32 coils, with the audio supplied from the PC and display, as you can see over there, supplied by a PC. When you're making a game with the Atmel, it gives you a pretty good development environment because you can write everything in C, and all the software is free, and the tools you use to build it, it's all free. You just have to buy a little programming dongle for $50, something like that, and then all the tools you need to compile and build all the code with all your rules and stuff to control the switches and lamps and coils, that's all free. So it's a pretty good way to get going. It's a well-supported environment, and you see the word free a lot, so free works. And I have this microcontroller, the one that controls the lamp switches and coils. This is connected to a PC just via a serial cable or a USB port, either way. And the AVR, like I said, just strobes the lamp matrix, scans the switch matrix, and it controls firing and releasing all the coils. On the PC side, I use the Java language for building all the game rules and showing the display and everything. Again, the nice thing about Java environments, all the tools you need are free. You can just download them. They're all free to use, and lots of books available if you don't understand or know much about Java programming. There's other languages to use. That's what I used. A lot of the game configuration I have is stored in XML files, which are just plain text files, describes, you know, all the switches and lamps and the names for them and some parameters and things. The Java code implements all the game rules and handles all the switch events, and it controls firing of the coils and what lamps to flash and what sounds to play and what to show on the LCD screen, writes logs and stuff like that. Lots of technical stuff. There's lots of timers to control all the asynchronous things that are going on. lots of other technical stuff here. But I have a console too where I can, if I want to do silly things, just create a sequence of commands to simulate somebody playing, I can do that, or I can capture a log of somebody playing it and play it back, things like that. The hardware, I used, again, a free package called Eagle for designing the schematics and the layout of the circuit boards. And then I would send those designs to Bulgaria to a company called Olimex, and they fabricate things very cheaply. Being from Canada, you always tend to get in trouble when you try and buy from U.S. companies because they want to ship everything by UPS, and it's very expensive. So if you're in the United States and you're doing something like this, you have a lot more choices because the shipping would be so much more economical. But for me, Bulgaria is the best place. I had to buy a lot of stuff to do this job. I spent a lot of time on eBay buying flipper units and drop target units and ramps and things I didn't need and things I thought I might need. And I spent a lot of time at the electronics store every Wednesday after Mike and I would go eat a hamburger. I'd go buy connectors and wire and stuff. And I have wire emphasized there because wire is expensive, and I probably spent, you know, over $200 just on wire for the game. And it's tough to get as many colors as you want, and then you buy cheap colored electrical tape and start wrapping your wires that way to get different colors. So I envy the manufacturers when you have all those colors they can use, and you see, you know, white with slate and orange tracers and stuff like that. I wish I could do that too. Gray with slate, yeah. When you're working on an EM game and it's dirty, the color of the wire you need is gray with a slate tracer or something like that. Okay, next. My play field is, I just bought a hunk of wood at Home Depot. It's called Baltic Birch. It's 11.5 millimeters thick, which is a little less than half an inch. Half an inch is 12.7 millimeters, so I'm a little bit under. And that was cheap and that works well, but boy, did I ever use a lot of washers when I was fitting units to make everything come out the exact height you want them to be. Some things it doesn't matter, but a lot of things you put on the playfield, it really matters if they're off by a millimeter. Like if you've got some inline drop targets and you don't want the ball to get stopped rolling over top of them. So I probably went through 200 washers, and I'd sit there at night gluing pairs of washers together and doing stupid things like that. So the next time I'm going to use a real half-inch piece of wood somehow. That would be a piece of advice I'd pass on there. The cabinet you see here, I think this was originally a Cleopatra? I think the body was a Cleopatra cabinet, and the head was from a Joker poker, which I traded to Mike. I had a countdown head, and I traded that to him, and he gave me Joker poker, and I sanded these down and used them. For the playfield, for making all the holes, I bought Forstner bits and Brad Point bits for making the holes. They made fairly nice, round, smooth holes without a lot of gouges on them, and I did a lot of this by hand. Obviously, if you're going to do this in mass quantities, you'd use a CAD layout and let somebody else do it with a routing machine. My father-in-law, he did a lot of the routing of the lamp inserts in the shooter lane for me, which was an enormous savings to myself in terms of time and effort, and I didn't have the skills to do this, and I didn't really want to experiment since I already had, you know, 40 or 50 hours of labor into this one piece of wood. I didn't want to experiment and chew it up by trying to make a triangular shaped hole. So I let my father-in-law, the master carpenter, do it, and he did it excellently. And you should see the shooter lane. It's just so smooth, and it's nicer than a lot of commercial games I've seen. Okay. In terms of design, I originally started with a scale pencil drawing. I mean, that's the way I did it 15 years ago. I converted this 2 years ago, and I used a scalable vector graphics format to lay everything out, and that was a mistake, and then I ended up spending 25 hours converting this and getting this into a real CAD program called TurboCAD, which I bought for $30, again, in my price range. I guess you could spend $1,000 for AutoCAD, but $30 works for me. For the artwork, I exported the TurboCAD file to a CorelDRAW for the artwork. So again, CorelDRAW, I think I paid about $30 or $35. So you can see the price range I'm working in with most of my tools here, trying to do it on a budget. For the artwork, it's the file was mostly vector graphics plus a few bitmap images, like raster images, photographs type of things. I had the Playfield artwork printed on transparent vinyl, but I kind of blew it because I didn't know you're supposed to put a white layer underneath. I kind of knew I needed a white layer under things that were going to be close to white, but I didn't realize I really needed that everywhere else. So the colors ended up horribly strange. And if you take a look later, or the game will be in the exhibit hall, you can have a look around, you'll see the very strange colors, and you can see some of the wood grain coming through and some of the flaws from below that I didn't think would ever be exposed. But the actual process of applying the vinyl, I took a lot of care to make sure the holes were lined up properly, but it went on beautifully, and so far has adhered beautifully and stood up beautifully. So while there's lots of other ways you can put paint on wood, this worked for me. And I think my total cost was maybe $200 for a one-off. So I thought that was fairly reasonable. Once I finally had the art on the play field, then I built it up. As I said, I spent a lot of money on eBay buying used assemblies. I went kind of crazy on flippers, and I think I still have like 14 flipper mechs left over, even though I only needed 4. But you go crazy on stuff like that. Sometimes you waste a lot of time buying this stuff, and sometimes you get ripped off or you get stuff you don't need and you just go out of control. But I eventually stopped, and I wanted to have enough parts for a second game, or if, you know, a unit breaks down in this game, that I would have a replacement unit. I did things like testing the major mechanisms, the flippers and the kickers, to make sure they worked properly, and you know, the very core things, core shots worked. Because I used a 25-volt Gottlieb style system instead of a 50-volt system, I would get Williams parts with Williams coils in it that were designed for higher voltages, and I'd have to swap them out. So I read a little bit to see what the equivalent would be in the Gottlieb world to provide the equivalent strength, and I did some tests, et cetera, there to prove it all out. To mount all the stuff in the playfield, I made a playfield rotisserie using Beaver. I think that's Ed Chung. I think he was the first one who pointed this out on the web, just with parts from Home Depot, some wood and some, I guess they're plumbing fixtures and joints. It was actually very easy to make. Again, $60. How can you beat that? You can certainly buy a higher quality one. Lots of people, I think, are making them now for, you know, $150 to $300. But mine works, and because it's just made out of 2x4s, I can adjust the size as necessary. So it's worked well for me. I wired everything up with when the game was on the rotisserie, used a lot of 18, 22, and 16-gauge wire. You got to use the correct wire. There's a lot of wire out there that's not really rated for more than 50 volts, so you should make sure you've got the right UL-rated wire. I think that's just a good starting point to use the correct stuff. And I had to buy a lot of tools. Tools. So you spend a lot of money buying tools. I'll talk about some of those tools later. For the back box, I had to build an adapter to hold the LCD in there. That's a 17-inch, just a Dell monitor I bought for $85. Then I had to stuff the PCBs in there. They're just up above where the artwork is. I'll open it up and show it to you. I had to build the front frame, the black frame you see, just so it looked, you know, reasonably done and not just tacked up. The grills in front of the speakers, that was just made from a filing tray at the office. I was standing there one day and I just saw this filing tray and I just swiped it, took it home and cut it up, and it was part of a pinball machine. So there we go. Everything can be used for pinball. There's lots of pieces of old VCRs in there for brackets and holding lamps and things too. You'd be amazed. Then I added the artwork on top. It's the size of the so-called back glass is really not much bigger than a video game marquee, which is probably nice to have it smaller than normal. That means less work. Okay. Before I finished the back glass, though, I worked on the cabinet. I just sanded it down with a belt sander, and then I primed it with white spray paint, and then put on some plain old ugly blue spray paint, Rust-Oleum brand. To me, the results were mediocre, and it took a long time to cure. If you're wearing white and you brush up against it, you'll probably have blue paint on you, so you have to be careful there. For the graphics, I put the vinyl graphics on the side. I, not having any artistic skills or artistic friends available, I just scanned a lot of frames out of old crime comic books from the 40s and 50s. It was sort of the perfect source for this type of subject matter, and that worked pretty good. The side art was just printed on vinyl, and it probably cost $100, something like that. It was fairly straightforward. I could have made the vinyl artwork fill the entire sides and have a piece to fill the front and fill the head like a lot of commercial games, but at that phase of the project, I didn't have time to work on it, and so I decided just to have smaller pieces that could be more or less slapped on and just fit in the confines of the side there. But it would be better, I guess, if you could have a full-sized piece. You just have to be wary, though, when you have a piece like that. I thought I needed one piece of art printed twice, but the lady told me, because the piece wasn't square, that I actually had to design a piece unique to each side, so don't get caught out for something silly like that. For the back glass art, again, I used Crime Comics scenes on there for most of the material and slapped it all together with CorelDRAW. You'd probably want to have a Translite printed, or Duratrans as they call it. That works pretty well and can be easily lit from behind, as you probably know. For me, it just happened to be cheaper to have it printed on translucent vinyl and stuck to a Lexan. I would have preferred to have a Duratrans, but again, it just happened to be cheaper in this case. If I'd had anything else I could have done at the same time to make a larger order, it would have been better to go the other way. But although you can't see it, it does look fairly good lit up from behind, but my GI lights are out right now, so sorry. There's a piece of clear Lexan in front of it just to protect it, and those pieces are sandwiched together with standard black edge clips that you can just buy from any pinball dealer. And all my lamps are number 47 6-volt bulbs. I'm not too fussy about them. I just keep the power draw down by using the 47s rather than 44s. When I was wiring the game, the game spent a lot of time on the rotisserie, months at a time. I kind of blew it. One thing I did was I didn't make the cables quite long enough. I mean, they do fit and reach into the head, and I allocated 4 feet, and I would think, oh, that's just great. That's long enough. And then I put it all together, and you realize you really want an extra foot so you can maneuver the play field around. So that's one of my big regrets, that I got all my cable lengths about a foot too short. So learn from my mistakes if you ever do something like this. All my connectors are Molex connectors, and you can buy tools for crimping these things. Once you've got a kit and you've got everything in place, it's pretty easy to do, and so far it's been pretty reliable. Used a staple gun to staple a lot of the wires down, like the lamp wires, just to make things neater and get things out of the way. And I went through hundreds of zip ties just to wrap all the cables together. And the wiring, you just tend to build the wires. They tend to go through what I call highways, just through the coil hills. You just seem to find the natural place for them to go. It'd be neat to have some of the old-time wiring experts like Ed Subula and all the guys at Gottlieb who could tell you all their hints and tricks for doing that sort of stuff, but I just winged it on my own there. When you get to playing the game, I've played hundreds of games testing the playfield layout and rules and testing out units, and within the confines of what I've done, because I had the art printed on there, I mean, it's kind of like a one-shot. I mean, if you're building a real game, you'd go through the iterative process of building different prototypes and making adjustments. For me, it was kind of like, okay, I'm only getting one shot at this, so I have to make it work. So I've done a lot of moving of posts around and tweaking it. It's still not perfect, and I think, you know, if you're going to go ahead with this commercially, you'd want to have at least a second prototype, and I know where I'd want to move some things over, but it would be hard to do right now. And I guess when you're going through this and designing it, you're looking at something and say, well, if I'm not shooting at it, if I make it worth more points, will I go for it then? And, you know, that's how you can get the rules in shape and get it all balanced. I'll always ask myself, is it fun? In many cases, it's not fun, but that's where you need the second prototype, I guess. I always think, does it comply with the design rules of the masters? It's kind of a list I compiled from different people and their tricks for building games. And are the rules balanced? These are questions you ask yourself. This is the fun part of the project. Will it keep me interested for a long time? You got to ask yourself. Or is it, you know, it's fun for 20 minutes and then I'm going to be sick of it? And in my case, will my kids like it? Those are my beta testers, Becky and Polly, and they help me and they tell me what's good or not good. Try and keep the rule complexity down. I guess my philosophy is the player should always understand the rules, not just the code. I mean, you can create layers and layers and layers of code, and you know, to the end player, I mean, they hit a target, it should just do something, and the cause and effect should be fairly obvious to them, I think, and not trigger a whole series or avalanche of rules and a hierarchy there that they wouldn't even understand. So I think the old Wayne Nyan school of design, a simple objectives but hard to obtain, I think that's always the key. So that's why I like playing old Gottlieb Woodrails. You know what you have to do, but it's still hard to do it. One of the things I did with this game is there's lots of top 10 lists maintained. So you have like the top 10 scores of the day, the top 10 scores of the week, the month, all time. And I found for my kids that kind of motivated them a bit, because they wanted to beat each other and beat me on the list. And it's actually a neat motivation for them to keep playing. And also for this game, there's sort of secondary stats I keep track of. So you can see if you've got the highest total for that particular stat, and you can also see all your top stats, your top values for each category. So it's just something to, you know, keep you motivated to keep going and try and do your best. And you have to have game scoped versus ball scoped rules. I guess that's pretty obvious. If you're having a bad game, you're on your last ball and you're not going to get the big score, well, let's see if you can do something interesting just on that ball, independent of the other balls in the game, and do something good there. Audio, there was a lot of work with audio. Don't know if you can see, I'm just using a standard Logitech Z2300 systems, but $120 at the time I bought it. It's still $100 at Best Buy and places like that. The subwoofer, you know, can handle 120 watts, and you know, it can be fairly loud and so forth. A lot louder than a standard game. Maybe we can try that out. Mike will go over and start a game up. Open the door first and crank up the volume a bit, Mike. It's down right down to the minimum, I think. Put it up to at least half there, and yeah, so. Because the coils aren't firing, you can't do too much on it there. But Michael diddle a few switches for us here, and you can at least see what would happen if the coils were working. Did you start the game? You gotta select your name first. There you go. In this game, you can set your name at the start of the game or the end of the game. When you're playing at home, it's nice to just set your name at the start of the game, because so you always know who you are, and your scores will be attributed to you, and keep track of your stats. You get all these useless bloops. There is more than bloops. So you get that. So you get that. That's a pop bumper sound here. Just me seeing it. So you can hear this is fairly loud. This is louder than I would have it in the house. But you can hear that at the back of the room, though, right?
So, hey, I got a big chimney going out the nightclub. How are you over?
So anyway, you can at least hear that. You can get some pretty loud audio for $100. And if you don't like that system, when the next one comes out, just go to Best Buy and buy that and slap it in, and then you got even louder audio. So I wrote a lot of code just to be able to play, you know, WAV and MP3 files, and you know, just short sound clips, and you could play MIDI too. The advantage of using a PC is you get all this multi-channel audio, you know, in stereo for free. You don't have to do any work for it. You just play all these sounds concurrently and they all sound good. And again, you just throw gigabytes of music on the hard disk of your PC, whatever you like to listen to. And you can use that for background music in a track mode song. So in a track mode, it'll sit there and just randomly play from a long list of songs. I used a software package called Audacity to record speech and do editing of sounds. Again, that's a free package, and it works pretty well. I used another package called Cool Edit. It's an old one, but they complemented each other. I talked about tools that are good to have. I guess some of these, or a lot of these, you probably already have in your toolbox if you're fixing games. But I just looked at what I have on the bench, and a lot of these were sort of my heavy hitters, the ones that I always go to. So I tended to use a lot of, the wire strippers and wire cutters for snipping ICs and, cutting diode legs and stuff like that. Used big wire cutters for hacking up steel and aluminum that you used for making lane guides and other brackets and so forth. Molex crimping tools. Clay has a lot of information about the exact part numbers you need from Molex for the crimpers and the terminals and headers and stuff. Long-handled screwdrivers. I never really had many of those until I started building a game, and they really came invaluable. So have long-handled screwdrivers for each of the type of screw heads you need. They're very valuable. Bench vise is useful for diagnosing electronics problems. You want to have a multimeter. I used an oscilloscope, but I'm not very good at using it. So the results are kind of dubious with it for me, but it's fun to play with, and it looks cool with all the waveforms wiggling by. Calipers. Files, small files, big files, punches, jumper wires, rivets, and a rivet gun for just making the lane guide brackets. Those are also tools I used a lot of. And at the bottom, I have your project log. I have it's kind of like a diary of everything I did since day one of the project, and it's the most valuable thing because you tend to work on something and get back to it 6 months later, and looking at the log was very valuable. I mean, it's over 180 pages of just typed in text. And I can't tell you how many times I'd have a problem. I'd say to myself, I think I had that problem 8 months ago, and I'd look and I could see the exact horror story back then and not go through the same horror story twice. At least I could reduce the number of horrors. My advice to anybody who wants to build a game is be realistic with your expectations. Don't fixate on super cool toys. Try and just get the basics right. Get the flippers flipping and pop bumpers popping and get all the basic stuff going. And, my philosophy always was a journey of, 1,000 miles starts with a single step. So do something. It doesn't have to be the greatest thing ever. And if you're smart, you'll have what I'd call a pinball rotary club. You'll have a bunch of friends who have the perfect resumes for you to help out. You'll have an electrical engineer. You'll have a coder, an artist, a sound guy, a designer, a woodworker, metal worker, and a mechanical engineer. It's your perfect group of friends if you want to build a game. And a cost account, yeah, the guy who does the bill of materials. Start with an old wired playfield like I did with Solar Ride. I would say that reduces the total effort of the project by 50% if you just start with an existing wired playfield. Having done Solar Ride and then done a full game, half the effort is in the playfield, and that doesn't even account for the getting the layout right and having to make a second prototype. I mean, if you start with a wired playfield, you're starting with a game that's already been gone through the ringer and been on location, been play tested and played and had a million sets of eyes on it. So I think that's a good way to start. And that's what a lot of people have done too. I would say look at kits and what other people are doing now. Jeff Matthews from the Snow Mountain Do-It-Yourself Game Company, I think that's what they're called. He's working on a game and they're building, I don't know if they're planning on building standalone kits or just selling customized games, but they're doing a lot of this development in a more professional way. The people from Nucor, I guess, are going to be here talking tonight about their Pinball 2000 replacement system and beyond what it can do. And you guys are probably familiar with Nuggie in Australia, who's been building a game too and doing things a bit differently than what I'm doing, and possibly having, you know, some sort of kits or hardware available for people to buy. I don't know, but there's lots of things for you to utilize out there without doing it all from scratch like I did. A lot of things I did from scratch because I wanted to do it from scratch and I wanted to learn and understand these topics. But if your goal is just to get a game together as quickly as possible, you don't have to be that stupid. You can possibly utilize what other people are doing. Pick a platform you can get parts for. I'm an old Gottlieb EM collector, so I've kind of familiar with those parts. And Gottlieb System 1 cabinets and parts and playfields are readily available, relatively speaking. But of course, if you've got a collection of 90s Williams games and you got spare Williams cabinets or spare Stern cabinets and hardware, pick that. The disadvantage of using a Gottlieb system is that, you know, they're now, the System 1 is like a 30-year-old platform and 30-year-old transformers that can break down on you before pinball shows. And ask yourself, how much do you want to do yourself? As I alluded to earlier, do you want to do it all yourself or do you want to just get the game done? Be realistic in whatever you think is going to work for you there. And be realistic on the time frame. Solar Rye took me 2 full years part-time. This game has been almost 3 years, and you know it still needs a little bit of cleanup before I call it quits on it. So that's a lot of time to spend on it. And I mean, I've been working till 11 p.m. most nights the last 30 days or so, just trying to get this game to this state, although not broken. But it's a lot of work. So don't think you're going to just blast it out in 6 months if you're going to, you know, go full bore on it. Just to recognize some other homegrown efforts that people have done. I start with a guy, Brent. I've never met him, but he's in Coldwater, Ontario, Canada, which is very close to where Mike and I are from, very close to where I grew up. He took a space shuttle game or something and turned it into a game called AC/DC based on the rock group. It's a really beautiful looking game. You can see video of it on the web, and he had a lot of people helping him, and that was a really, really good effort. A few years ago at Expo, there were these two brothers from Montreal, I think they just called themselves Bras, and they created a game called Nebula. And these guys were really crazy because they created all their own assemblies. I think they started in the copper mines of Peru to mine their copper and form the wire. And I mean, they did everything and created a really nice looking game. If you look on the web, you can see a Batman game by Scott Elder, who's done a few Batman things, I think. It's pretty serious looking effort. You may have seen Evan Kay in Washington created a Futurama game. I think it was based on Superman. It's a really beautiful looking game, and if you like the Futurama TV show, you'd be impressed with that. I think it has a DVD player on the playfield or something like that. As we mentioned, Nuggy is making his Coconut Island game in Australia, and there's lots of YouTube video and comments on that game. I think he's just about done. And the Snow Mountain people are making a game called Creepy Crypt, which I think maybe they'll talk about. And, you know, there's other people who've done games too, you know, sort of too numerous to list. These are games that I've actually seen pictures of on the web and described, so I just stick to what I've actually seen here. But I know there's more efforts, and if you Google on the web, you'll see there's lots of people making games. Who knows how far they're getting, but I think you'd be surprised at how many people are actually out there with efforts, and if some people come up with some standardized systems, it could make it go a lot easier for these people. And you know, Ed Chung was using FPGA technology to replace some boards for some WPC games. I mean, that's exciting just for the replacement aspect, but could be used as a good development tool in the future as well. And to me, the ultimate irony is this game over here started out as a virtual game as part of a PC simulation package. And today it's a real game, and I could play that simulation package inside this game. So, you know, I've kind of, the bubble has been reversed and the inside has been flipped to the outside and so forth. So I find that very odd, you know, 12 or 13 years later that I can now play that original package inside this game. the work continues. I like this photo just because of the glow of the lights. That was the game in my basement. See, you can see there really is GI lights at the top of the back glass. I wasn't making it up. Yeah, it wasn't done in Photoshop, and it wasn't Mike standing behind there with a flashlight. So I've played hundreds of games, and it's been working great until I got here, but we'll see if we can get it going in the exhibit hall. And that's about it, unless there's any questions. I look around at those sometimes. I see various websites that do have information on home-built games, and they're invariably incomplete. And I've seen efforts that aren't mentioned anywhere else because they might have only been a university project. You see a lot of people building a pinball machine's a great exercise for if you're in electronics in university, electrical engineering or something like that. Excuse me. So a lot of people pick building a pinball machine as a university project. So there's been a few of those that you don't see mentioned very often. Yes, sir. Well, there's two costs. There's the cost of what's actually in the box there, and I don't have that added up, but it could be, I'll take a guess and say $1,500. But I've probably, if you look at tools and the wire I've bought and spare parts, I might have another $2,000 or $3,000. Well, my wife's here, I should say another $200 or $300. But yeah, so it could be more expensive or less expensive. The PC I'm using inside the game cost me $79, so you don't need to have a top of the line machine for that to run it. So yes, sir. No, but it's definitely, I started in January of 2006 on this game, so it's been close to 3 years. The time I spend each week is variable. There was probably some periods when I was, stalled on artwork or something I was confused about that I didn't work on it, but I'd say for the last year, I've worked on it 5 to 10 hours every week on average, let's say. So, over 3 years, it could be 1,000 hours. And then, I'm leveraging stuff I did on the Solar Ride project before that, so that was probably another 500 hours or something. So it was a lot. But again, I'm going from first principles on a lot of things. I'm not just grabbing stuff off the shelf from other people. Anybody else? Yeah, I think it varies, but, sort of in the ballpark of $30 to $60 each, and I've got 4 or 5 that I had made up, plus a couple others I just soldered on some, breadboard type thing or strip board. I've just made one of each. There were some cases where I could get two made for the price of one, so I would get the second one made, and it's just sitting there as a spare, but just one at a time for now. I can get them redone for the same price again, so shipping, even though it's from Bulgaria, wasn't very much. Oh, yeah, I'm sure there are. But again, just when you're doing a one-off and being able to do just one and do it for $30 is really good. You can spend a lot more if you're not smart about it, that's for sure. Yep. I'm just talking about the plain boards, and I would solder the components myself. Everything is through-hole components. my eyes aren't that good for doing... surface mount stuff, so yeah, that the cost of the chips is usually $10, except for maybe the CPU, the Atmel CPU, which was $40 or $50, something like that. They're just double-sided two-layer. They're just simple, very simple. And the only restriction was by using the Eagle package for creating the schematics. That package is free, but you're limited in size to boards this big. So that complicates my life in order to save money. If I could make boards of any size and I could get one or two made and throw a lot of stuff on it and save costs there, and it would be easier, but just to save money, I would just do it that way. Yes, sir? So the question is, can I use the boards for other games? And the answer is... yes, if I make another game, I would hope to be able to just print off all these circuit boards again and use the same software and just use that so that I don't have to think about lamps and switches and coils. All I got to worry about is the game rules. And in terms of tests, you know, what I have isn't very advanced in terms of, you know, checking for short circuits. I know, you know, some of the later Williams, the driver boards or whatever, they'll have, you know, they'll have comparators testing to make sure that there isn't a short circuit and cut everything off. I don't have anything advanced like that. I mean, that's beyond my capabilities and costs and et cetera right now. Back at the back there? To communicate from the PC to the... it's just through a serial port connection. And serial ports are hard to get on PCs these days, so I think I'm actually, it's like a USB connection on the PC and a serial cable on the other end using a $25 FTDI-based 232 card. So it's the serial, so you can, it's just standard serial port programming, and it's fairly reliable running at 38 kbps. It, you could go a bit faster, but that's, you know, that was fast enough for what I was doing. Oh, ramps. Yeah, I didn't mention I also did a bit of vacuum forming. The main ramp in the center of the game, if you look at it, is from Hurricane, I think. But the I needed an extension piece to make it come back to the inlane, so I bought on eBay a little vacuum forming machine from somebody. I can only make pieces up to like 11 inches long, but it was like $75. I went to a plastics manufacturer and bought a 4x8 sheet of PETG, and I can vacuum form stuff like that if it's small. And I've got one or two other vacuum form pieces on there too. So, and I think Clay's site has a lot of information about that, and you know, you can do it in your oven if you like, although don't let your wife know about it. So there's lots of things you can do there too, but that was another thing I had to do. Yes. Yeah, the game, it's a multi-ball game. It's got an auto fire plunger, so it has three-ball multi-ball, and it's, you can set the number of balls per game. I've got it set to 3 balls per game. I played 5 balls for a while, but I tend to like most games at 3, and then just keeps it a little bit shorter. But yeah, it's a Gottlieb trough unit, Gottlieb multi-ball trough unit from, I don't know, the late 80s or early 90s. Yes. Holiday. Hooligans Holiday. No more of this stuff for a while. Just finish it off. But yeah, I'd like to make another game down the road. Maybe not a pinball game, just something smaller. A 3-year scope project is really a lot of work, and I'd really like to have a shorter project next time. A 1 to 1.5 year project would be great, you know, if I'm building something else. Yep. Yeah, I haven't... I didn't have a lot of time. You can burn up a lot of time doing video stuff. For me, it's very plain. It's just text oriented. I can display images. There's a picture of a head there. I've got different message areas on the screen. I didn't have time, but yeah, I could insert video clips, and you know, then you could go all out and spend a lot of time doing, you know, actual building animation like in Pinball 2000 or something like that. But that's a lot of effort, especially at home. I mean, I could spend years doing that, I guess. But yeah, it's all possible. Anything you can do on a PC, you could do here. So, okay, I think that's it. Thank you. Thank you very much.